This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Martin Scorsese. His new film, The Irishman, was just nominated for 10 Oscars, including Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Supporting Actor for Joe Pesci and Al Pacino. It's available for streaming on Netflix and is playing in select theaters. The Irishman reunites Scorsese with Robert De Niro, who starred in Scorsese's Mean Streets, Taxi Driver, and The King of Comedy. De Niro and Pesci starred in Scorsese's Raging Bull, Goodfellas, and Casino. The Irishman, adapted from the book I Heard You Paint Houses, is based on the stories of three real people who were involved in organized crime. Pesci plays Russell Bufalino, a crime boss in northeastern Pennsylvania. Pacino plays Jimmy Hoffa, the powerful leader of the Teamsters Union, who disappeared in 1975 and was presumed murdered. De Niro plays Frank Sheeran, a World War II veteran and truck driver who became Bufalino's assistant and sometimes hitman, and later, as the film tells it, became Hoffa's bodyguard and right-hand man. The film is told from the perspective of Sheeran when he's an old man in an assisted living facility looking back on his life. Reviewing the film in the New York Times, A.O. Scott called it Scorsese's least sentimental picture of mob life, and for that reason, his most poignant. Let's start with a song that we hear when the film opens and we enter the assisted living facility. It's the 1956 recording of In the Still of the Night, recorded by the Five Satins. Martin Scorsese, welcome to Fresh Air. Thank you so much for coming to our show. Why did you want to start The Irishman with that song?
You know, I always think of music first, in a way, that accompanies the type of picture I want to make, or what that, actually the atmosphere, the mood, or music that reflects the world, not in terms of nostalgia. That's very important. That devalues it, I think. But in terms of this particular film, that was the only piece of music I heard in my head. Basically, it has to do with a sense of coming to terms, or as best you can come to terms with the end of your life. I used to listen to many, many sermons back in the early 50s by the older Italian priests. Who were administering to the Italian-American community in the Lower East Side. And the main theme often was about death and about death approaching like a thief in the night. You never know when, you never know how. And then there's non-existence.
I wish I could show these two shots, but I want to contrast two shots, one in Goodfellas and one in The Irishman. There's a scene in Goodfellas where Ray Liotta's character is walking into the Copacabana, this like really swank nightclub, and it's a long tracking shot. You see him get out of the car, he walks in, and you know there's a twisting route that he takes through the kitchen and through the back rooms of the casino, and then from like backstage they enter the actual club, and suddenly a table appears for them, and it's this really long shot, and it's all about the glamour he's showing. Is it his wife yet or a girlfriend then? I'm trying to remember.
His girlfriend.
Yeah. And so he's showing her like the glamour and power, you know, that he has access to now. Mm-hmm. So compare that with the opening shot in The Irishman, where it's a long tracking shot in an assisted living facility where it's going through the rooms and the hallway, and we're seeing like people on walkers and in wheelchairs. We see like aides coming and going, and mm-hmm. people playing checkers, and I think it's cards. And then the camera stops on Robert De Niro's character, Frank Sheeran, who's in a wheelchair. And so you have this long tracking shot about glamour, as opposed to this long tracking shot at the end of life in a nursing home where there, an assisted living facility, I should say, where there's like no glamour. Is that a comment on the difference between these two films, or a comment on how you see that life differently now, or just a comment about aging? Like, how would you contrast those two views?
The opening shot of Irishman, in a sense, played itself out by listening to the music in the still of the night. And when I heard the song, I just knew we had to be floating down the hall of these assisted living facility and wind up on this old man sitting in a chair. I get it. I knew that when I determined that it would be compared to the long take in Copacabana in Goodfellas, but it didn't matter because ultimately, you know, it's been 20 years or so, and I spent a lot of time in these places, in hospitals and emergency rooms and kind of assisted living places, and I see the people. I've been involved with some things that, you know, people having difficult times of their lives, and also just people ending the end of their lives. And I know the routines. I know what it's like in the middle of the night in the hospital while you're waiting there because a patient is very close to you. And what do? You just sit there. Nurses go by. The light changes. Lives go by. Beds go floating by. You know, and all these lives, we know nothing about them. They just become old and gone. And it's a whole life has gone by, in a way. And these are the ones who survive, in a sense, to that old age. But it's the mood and tone of those places that I spent a lot of time in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not even as simple as saying, well, now I look back and I realize gangsters are bad. I know they're bad. I know it's bad, you know? And I think there's always been this this issue of glamorization of the gangster. The point is, of course, that because of my religious beliefs or concerns or obsessions, it has to do with, can a person change? And can a person be redeemed? Or if a person isn't redeemed, how should I put it? Part of our human nature, the bad part of our human nature, the evil, it's still human nature. We can't put it aside, you see. We can't say it doesn't exist. And if that's part of us, and it may be part of every one of us, what are we capable of?
Yeah, because your film, in a way, is kind of asking a question. If you've been able to be a hitman and to kill people through a good deal of your adult life, when you are facing death, what do you feel? Do you feel regret? Do you feel a remorse? Can you repent at the last minute? Does that count?
No,
does that make
repent
up for
at the
it?
Last minute is like, I don't know. That's always the deathbed Catholic routine, you know? I'm not quite sure. I mean, look, he is alone. He's alone, and who's he got to talk to? This very young priest, very nice young man, who he might as well be talking to a person from outer space. That young man has no way of understanding the world he came from. On the other hand, the priest does try to understand, it tries to get him to at least acknowledge some kind of remorse. And all I think that Frank could come up with, and it's a line I insisted we have in there, is he said, don't you feel anything? He said, well, I'm paraphrasing the line, but it's something to the effect that, well, I'm here, I guess that means something. Meaning he's open to talking. That's the beginning of some kind of admission and some kind of trying to come to terms with who he is. It's something. There are other people who won't talk at all. And close the door and that's the end of it. Never hear from them.
So I want to play a very brief clip from Goodfellas. And this is from the very beginning of the film where Ray Liotta as Henry Hill, who becomes the wise guy, the small-time connected guy, he's a child in this. But we hear Ray Liotta's narration as he's looking out the window at what's going on in the street below.
To me, being a gangster was better than being president of the United States. Love is all that ever.
Even before I first wandered into the cab stand for an after-school job, I knew I wanted to be a part of them. It was there that I knew that I belonged. And to me, it meant being somebody in a neighborhood that was full of nobodies. They weren't like anybody else. I mean, they did whatever they wanted. They double parked in front of a hydrant, and nobody ever gave them a ticket. In the summer, when they played cards all night, nobody ever called the cops. Must I forever
be? It's so interesting to me in that scene that he thinks that that's what power is, that you can double park in front of a fire hydrant
to a child.
And not get a ticket. Did you think that
to
too?
Child.
Did you relate? Did you relate to that?
Well, not myself, but I knew other people around me certainly did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had no education. You know, they were very poor. There's a lot of street life, and the street life at a certain point, some of the kids couldn't read. One or two were illiterate. I was surprised. There were others, of course. We were in Catholic school. We were in St. Patrick's School with the Sisters of Mercy, I believe, on Mott Street. So we were going to school, and we were told to go to school. But, you know, many people, say my parents, I'll refer to my parents, they didn't have any understanding of what I would be doing in life, you know. As far as my older brother, they just wanted him to get a steady job.
Mm-hmm.
Because he left high school in the first year. He wouldn't go back. But I didn't. I had asthma and that sort of thing, and I stayed in school. It was the only place where I felt between the school and the church and the movie theater is where I had a sense of the other world and a sense of might as well stay here because the rest of this place is pretty crazy in a sense.
So those were the safe places, school, church,
those were the safe
home?
Places.
What, you're laughing. I'm sorry. What's so funny?
No, and they weren't that safe, I could tell.
They weren't that safe. Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, I can imagine school not being very safe. Church, I figure, was probably safe.
Yeah, but it was the old style, you know, and it was the old style. But you know what I mean in terms of corporal punishment and that sort of stuff. But there was
a
lot of love.
Of course, right.
But there was a lot of love from those particular nuns. It was very interesting how they worked it. But in any event, you have to understand... I was on Elizabeth Street between Houston and Prince, living there. My parents were born on that block. My father at 241 Elizabeth Street, and my mother across the street at 232. And the Bowery was known as Devil's Mile. The next block over to my left was Mott, then Mulberry, and Mulberry was known as Murder Mile. Okay? So now, for different reasons, Devil's Mile... The people went there and they died. They were alcoholic guys, men and women, who basically a lot of them were, I got to tell you, a lot of them were, had fought with George Patton. A lot of them were vets and they just collapsed. And it was an extraordinary place to be and be with them. It was very disturbing and eye-opening and also interesting. When they were sober, sometimes they'd talk to you about things that you didn't know, another world, you know. But Murder Mile, Mulberry was called Murder Mile at that time, apparently because they used to drop off bodies that were executed. And so it permeated the daily tragedies of those poor guys, men and women on the Bowery, and well, again, a tragedy of people taking the wrong turn, like in Mean Streets or in Casino, and winding up dead in the streets.
Before you decided to become a filmmaker, did you ever think about becoming a priest?
Oh, yes, yeah. I thought that was... it made sense. It made sense. They spoke about, put in simplistic terms, good and evil, you know? But how the hell are we supposed to live in this life? The morality, you call it morality, I guess, but it's the human condition. You know, what do we do? What are we supposed to do? And my father taught us certain things, you know, between right and wrong. It was very strong, a very strong opinion. But I saw different things in the street, I could tell you. And not even to get into the kind of thinking that's an Irishman. That's another level. That's somewhere else and has nothing to do with me. But, meaning when I was growing up. But, there's one priest, Father Principe, he made a difference. He told us, you know, you don't have to live this way.
Mm-hmm.
Don't get married right away if you don't need to. Think explore the world.
But you didn't become a priest, so what made you change your mind?
No, what happened was that you can't become a priest because you want to be like the priest who was your mentor.
Mm-hmm.
Once you get in and say, wait a minute, this is really serious.
Right.
You have to have what they call a vocation, you know? And it's like, you have to love the Mass. You have to understand what that means. And I didn't know. I didn't know. And it was a major shock. I was... expelled from this preparatory seminary.
How come you were expelled?
Well, I didn't do any more. I stopped after about 2 months of doing the work. I just stopped doing the work and behaved badly, class clown kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Did you want to be expelled? Were you trying to get out of it, but didn't want to say
know.
That you were leaving?
I didn't know. I guess it wasn't, I told everybody, and I had this kind of holier-than-thou routine going on.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my son's going to be a priest, you know. That they didn't like that, but basically that's what he wants, and he was always sickly anyway. You know, let him go there, and that sort of thing. And then, you have to come back like the prodigal son, completely, in a failure. You're a failure. I was 15.
So did it feel better to kind of like get thrown out, because that's a kind of like statement, as opposed to saying like, oh,
no.
I don't want to do it?
No. I knew I was missing something truthful, and
mm-hmm.
I knew I was missing the very essence of how you should live.
Mm.
I really did.
Did you feel like you could find that essence through art, through making movies,
yes,
and through watching
ultimately.
Them?
Ultimately. Yeah, ultimately. But that took a little while. I mean, it was always there.
Mm-hmm.
I was, doing things with my friends and stuff like that, and cinema... Movies had become like so important to me, because I would go to just basically spend a lot of time there. I couldn't really play sports or anything like that. Maybe I should have been like Teddy Roosevelt, who did everything, with that asthma, but my parents are old fashioned, and as I said, uneducated in a way, and the doctor said, don't do this, you didn't do it. That was it.
So I just want to read a little bit of what your schedule was like in the 70s. This is a list of years and films for you. Boxcar Bertha, 1972. Mean Street, 73. Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, 74. Taxi Driver, 76. New York, New York, 77. The Last Waltz, 78. Raging Bull, 1980. King of Comedy, 1982. I'm just thinking your schedule must have been insane.
Yes.
And that must have been like a whole lot of stress on
you. Yeah. And eventually
physically
it just
and emotionally.
Collapsed. Yeah, it just collapsed. And out of that came Raging Bull, ultimately.
So you collapsed, and then you made Raging Bull?
Yeah.
What was the collapse like?
Well, it collapsed with, the same old story. I got to tell you, whether it's drugs or not, you want to get into drugs. But the issue is, with the failure of New York, New York, or considered failure, so to speak.
I like that film a lot.
Yeah, exactly. At that time, it was considered a terrible flop. They considered that. People now look at it and say it was very, very different. Okay, but with that failure and the, for me, a certain artistic failure for this big experiment that I wanted to try, there was a lack of, something happened. It was like, I felt the creativity was just punched out of me. And you sought some interesting times with taking these drugs and that sort of thing. But ultimately, it was an experiment, a curiosity, to try to find if I could ever care enough to get back on a set, to care enough. I didn't care anymore. And I had to find if I can make another film. I felt
What was it about Raging Bull that made you feel that again?
Because that's what he goes through.
Oh.
See?
Right.
But I didn't know that. De Niro knew it.
Huh.
He more or less knew it because he also wanted to be in it. He had been working out. We were 35 and 36 years old, and he knew that he really had to make it as soon as possible, because physically what he wanted to do was gain all that weight. It was going to be very hard for him if he got older. And he knew I was the right person to make it, and he kept pushing me, and I kept rejecting it for like 2 years. I don't know anything about sports. Boxing to me was always an image of... an image on a 16-inch screen in black and white of two small figures kind of moving around a white square. What is that? I never went to a fight, so I don't know. I saw fights in the street, yes, but not in a ring,
mm-hmm.
And I knew, certain things about it. But ultimately, I also didn't know how to shoot it. So I came up with my own way of shooting it, like music, see? So like covering music, like in The Last Waltz, for example, and in New York, New York. And I applied those same principles to the fight scenes in Raging Bull. But primarily it's the rebirth, in a way. He's reborn. And I thought pretty much that was it. But it took about 25 years before we could agree on the subject matter to make our next film, and that became Irishman.
Do you still consider yourself Catholic?
I think so, yes. Yeah.
And, like, have your beliefs changed from what you believed about, like, heaven and hell and life and death from when you were an altar boy?
Well, of course, you were a child, and you had the faith of a child.
Exactly.
So what's the St. Paul thing? I put away childish things.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're stuck with the adult things.
So I want to thank you not only for your movies, but for the movies you've introduced me to. You've restored a lot of movies.
Oh, yes.
And you, like, years ago, you were reissuing a bunch of movies on DVD. And one of them I'm especially grateful for is Johnny Guitar, which is one of my favorite films now. And it's such a great Western. It transcends the Western form. But
yes, it does, yeah.
So I always think of you as, like, a great filmmaker and also a great film teacher. So thank you for both.
Thank you. Thank you.
Martin Scorsese's new film, The Irishman, is nominated for 10 Oscars, including Best Actor and Best Director. In the early 1960s, saxophonists Eddie Lockjaw Davis and Johnny Griffin co-led a jumping two-tenor band. A live recording has now surfaced. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says it's literally a blast from the past.
Saxophonists Eddie Lockjaw Davis and Johnny Griffin from the album Al, Live at the Penthouse, a new issue from 1962. It's a love letter to fans who think that jazz can never swing hard enough, that the music is all about that springy, propulsive rhythm. Personally, I don't insist on it every second, but swing is one of jazz's great pleasures, a rhythm feel at once buoyant and tough. Showing how it's done, our airy pianist Horace Parlin, tireless bass walker Buddy Catlett, and heavy drum swinger Arthur Taylor. They bring that lift even at killer tempos. Johnny Griffin gets top billing on Al, Live at the Penthouse. But on their old LPs, that honor went to the slightly older Lockjaw Davis. He makes the stage announcements here, and usually solos first, with an agreeably raspy tone and imposing rhythmic swagger. Here's Lockjaw on Bahia. One sound reason for Lockjaw Davis to solo first was not a good idea to follow Johnny Griffin. Tenor pairings are less about competition and mutual respect and a celebration of contrasting styles. But Griffin did have a competitive streak. He didn't need to win every battle, but gave the impression that was in his power. He was scary fast, the way John Coltrane was in 1962. Here's Johnny Griffin on that same tune after the rhythm trio jacks up the tempo. Johnny Griffin. On the trades at the end of a few tunes, where the tenors volley short phrases back and forth, the saxophonists egg each other on like good friends. They also take mutual delight in negotiating insane tempos, as on Tickletoe. Love the burry sound of their lashing into the melody there. Johnny Griffin and Eddie Lockjaw Davis's Al Live at the Penthouse was recorded at that Seattle jazz room that musicians like to play. That was during a 10-day stand in late spring 1962, just as Seattle tourism was getting a boost from the recently opened World's Fair with its Space Needle. Great live gigs are usually lost to the ages, but by good fortune, these 2 half-hour sets were broadcast over local radio and got recorded with good sound, and those tapes got preserved and remembered. Which is how this still fresh music is now before our ears, as if unearthed from a World's Fair time capsule.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Point of Departure and the Audio Beat. He reviewed Ow, Live at the Penthouse, featuring saxophonist Johnny Griffin and Eddie Lockjaw Davis, recorded in 1962. My guest Peggy Orenstein is the author of the new book Boys and Sex, Young Men on Hookups, Love, Porn, Consent, and Navigating the New Masculinity. It's a follow-up to her book, Girls and Sex. She's been chronicling girls' lives for about 25 years, including in her earlier books, Schoolgirls, Don't Call Me Princess, and Cinderella Ate My Daughter. She never expected to be writing about boys, but after the Me Too movement and revelations of widespread sexual misconduct, including the now infamous list of famous men, she thought it was time to engage young men in conversations about gender and intimacy. Her book, Boys and Sex, is based on extensive interviews with over 100 college and college-bound boys aged 16 to 22. Heads up to parents of young children, like the book title says, we're going to be talking about teenagers and sex, but there's nothing explicit. Peggy Orenstein, welcome back to Fresh Air. Was it harder for you to talk about sex with boys than it was to talk about sex with girls?
Well, my biggest fear with boys, actually, was that they wouldn't talk at all. You know, teenage boys don't exactly have a reputation for chattiness. And I was surprised, and maybe the biggest surprise for me in doing the whole project, was how eager they were to talk. And while I thought it would be maybe awkward or that they wouldn't want to talk to a woman. That proved not to be true at all. And they were super candid. They were super blunt. They talked a lot about what boys don't usually talk about, feelings. And I think the reason was that we just don't give boys permission or space to discuss their interior lives and talk about what's going on with them. So when they had the chance, when somebody really gave it to them and wasn't going to be judgmental about what they had to say, they went for it.
So, you know, you write that feminism has given girls an escape from the constraints of conventional femininity. But for boys, the traditional concept of manhood still holds sway. I want you to explain the difference that you found between girls and boys in trying to escape from the constraints of gender roles and gender preconceptions.
Yeah, I mean, with boys, on one hand, they saw girls as equals and deserving of their place on the playing field and in class and in leadership, and they had female friends. So that had really changed. But I would ask them all the time to just give me a kind of lightning round of the ideal guy. And when we would do that, it was like they were channeling 1955, and it was still all about stoicism, sexual conquest, dominance, aggression, or this weird combination now of being both aggressive and chill, athleticism, wealth. It was really narrow, and they would talk a lot particularly about that piece of suppressing feelings. And a lot of guys would say to me that they had learned how to build a wall inside them to block off any feelings except maybe happiness and anger. And they would talk about training themselves not to feel or training themselves not to cry. That was actually a really big one. And it took me a while. And again, I think this was being a woman, to recognize what they were saying to me when they would tell me how, you know, about times they had cried or times they almost cried, like how big that was for them and how hard that was for them. So
it was humiliating for them.
It was humiliating, yeah. And that's a really good point, because I think a lot of what the boys were wrestling with or struggling with, it was about humiliation, but it was also about really about vulnerability and the kind of imperative that they not make themselves vulnerable, whether it was in a hookup or whether it was with another guy. One guy talked to me about how he liked to partner with girls in school projects because it was okay to say you didn't know what you were doing with a girl and you couldn't do that with a guy. But that idea of emotional vulnerability was so profound for boys. And we know that vulnerability is basically essential to human relationships. So when you cut boys off from the ability to be vulnerable, you're doing them a huge disservice. And I started thinking, you know, when I was doing the girl book, that the kind of core issue with girls was that they were being cut off from their bodies and not understanding their body's response and their needs and their limits and their desires. And with boys, it felt like they were being cut off from their hearts. And that was having a huge impact on how they conducted personal relationships and what was available to them in personal relationships.
For boys who talked with you about that, where did they think that inability to cry without humiliation or the inability to access or express feelings, where did they think it came from? Pop culture, the way they were brought up by their mm-hmm. parents?
I mean, all of that, right? I mean, certainly the media barrages them with that idea of male sexual entitlement and female sexual availability and submission. But yeah, their dads. I mean, they talked a lot about their dads or the male role model in their lives. And it wasn't just guys who said, yeah, my dad told me to man up or don't be a little bitch or something like that. It was also a lot of guys who would say things like, you know, my dad was a loving, charismatic guy. I didn't learn sexism or homophobia from him, but I did learn that stunted side of masculinity because he was sort of a sigh and walk away kind of guy, not the person who'd talk to you about something. So I learned not to have those conversations from him.
So you talk with boys who understood feminism, who, you know, kind of got it intellectually, but didn't necessarily behave that way. They were afraid to object if they saw other boys behaving in a very sexist way, or, you know, trying to be too aggressive with a woman at a party, afraid to alienate male friends who were, like, speaking in an obnoxious way about girls or behaving badly. So can you explain that that disconnect between having certain beliefs but not being able to act on them sometimes?
That pressure to silence was so intense for boys. I always think about this one guy who was telling me that when he was a sophomore in high school, he tried to stand up when he was on crew team to a senior who was saying something despicable about girls. And the other guys mocked him. And he had done this with a friend. And next time it happened, the friend stood up, but the boy I was talking to stayed silent. And he said to me, "The more I watched my friend stand up to this, the more I saw other guys not like him as much." And he looked at me and he said, "You know, I don't want to have to choose between my dignity and being part of this team, but how do I make it so I don't have to choose?" And that was a real central conundrum to guys, that part of what makes you a man is bragging about sexual conquest and that whole idea of, you know, locker room banter, which we now know is a thing. So when guys are together, the way they're supposed to talk about sex, you know, they pound, they hammer, they nail, they smash, they bang. It's like they just visited a construction site, not like they engaged in an act of intimacy. And that could be really troubling to a lot of guys, but the cost on, you know, you can become a target if you stand up to that. You can be marginalized if you stand up to that. So there is a lot of pressure to stay silent if you're not going to engage in it. And that silence in itself is kind of how boys become men.
At the risk of stating the obvious, if you're using the kind of assaultive language, you know, like "I slammed her" or "hammered," what are the odds you're going to behave in a tender way when you're actually with a woman?
Well, yes, there's that. And the other piece of it that also played into that, I became really interested in this whole idea of the word hilarious and funny and the ways that boys use that to deflect when they feel that something is inappropriate or aggressive or reprehensible, or when they get sent a really raunchy or violent pornographic meme, because hilarious was this default position. Like, you're always safe in terms of that masculinity issue. Nobody's going to target you. Nobody's going to mock you if you just say hilarious. But that's another way that boys' hearts and heads get disconnected. It's another way that they can't actually express what they know to be true. And it's another way that they learn to dehumanize women and potentially their female partners.
I think, you know, like, women and LGBTQ people have really made a point of, you know, stating really loudly in so many different platforms in so many different ways that it's not good to use words describing anything female-related, female body parts, or gay-related, or derogatory words for any of the above, to use those as a way of insulting a man. Because it's a way also of insulting a girl or a woman or somebody who's LGBTQ. How much of that has actually penetrated into the culture of teenage boys, the culture of the boys who you interviewed and wrote about in your book?
Well, so it was really interesting because on one hand, boys used that word, that epithet for gay, a lot with each other. But what they would say to me, this is straight boys talking, is the idea that they would never say that to a gay person. Right? That they had gay friends. They, you know, they weren't homophobic, but they used that word all the time. And it had become basically a slur on masculinity, not so much a statement of sexual orientation. But I think that word, that slur for gay, is what kind of draws the lines of the man box for boys. And basically, the fear of being called that shuts down any objection to stepping up and standing out. So it polices boys, basically. And I also was really interested in No Homo. C.J. Pascoe, who's a sociologist in Oregon, had done a survey of the way boys use that hashtag on Twitter. And it wasn't just a homophobic slur. It was also a protective shield that allowed them to express just really basic human ideas about affection and joy. So they would say, like, I miss you, man, hashtag no homo. Or even something as innocuous as, I like chocolate ice cream, hashtag no homo. It was just a way that allowed them to be fully human, really.
You write that you were struck by how much more willing and able queer boys were than straight ones to negotiate sexual consent. What were some of the differences you found?
Yeah, that was something that was a big surprise and a big takeaway for me, was that gay boys were so much more willing and able and capable to negotiate the terms of their sexual experiences with their partners. And that's partly because, you know, they sort of have to, because what's going to happen is not necessarily obvious. But they were always so befuddled by the resistance among straight guys to doing that, because they would say, you know, if we're talking about it, it means, you know, we're going to have sex, and that's great. Why would you think that was a bad thing? So listening to them was really educational, I think, was really useful for straight kids. And what Dan Savage, who is a columnist who writes about sex, says is there are four magic words that gay guys use in a sexual encounter, which is, what are you into? And the beauty of that phrase is that it's a truly open-ended question. It's not a yes or a no to a set of possibilities that is predetermined or decided by the other person, but it's a conversation. And that's ultimately what one is aiming for in this whole discussion of consent, is to make sex a conversation that people can have, you know, not just for the legality of it, but so that it will be a more mutually gratifying experience for everybody involved.
You have a whole chapter about how can we raise boys to be better men. What do you mean by better men? And what are some of the suggestions that you have?
When you talk about better men, you know, I think it's a really exciting task. And to be able to raise guys who are compassionate and egalitarian and respectful of boundaries and capable of connection and vulnerability and love, and who can sustain relationships and who are happier and more fulfilled themselves, you know? And writing that chapter was really interesting for me, because in the past, in my books, I have, in a final chapter, always profiled somebody or gone into some situation that would sort of exemplify the values or ideas that I was trying to get across. But I have now been writing about teenagers and sex for 9 years, and I felt like I could come out behind the curtain a little bit and talk about the ways that having these conversations, which I know for a lot of parents, you would rather poke yourself in the eye with a fork than speak directly to your son about sex, and probably he would rather poke himself in the eye with a fork as well. But we really don't have the luxury in this current culture of silence, because if we don't talk to our kids, the media is going to educate them for us, and we are not going to love the result.
So your new book is about boys and sex. Your previous book was about girls and sex, and we're talking about teenagers. And you've also been very alert to the Me Too movement. And I'm wondering how the combination of all of that, if that's led you to recalculate some of your own teenage experiences and your experiences in your 20s. And if you've reinterpreted some of the experiences that you've had.
I think we all have. I was actually just having this conversation yesterday with a friend and her college-age daughter about this. And my friend was saying, do you think it's really worse now than it was when we were young? And I said, well, there's so many things that we just accepted as the price of admission as women when we were younger. I found a notebook that I had from a college English class where I was writing notes back and forth with a friend about another friend who had gone over to a male professor's house, and he had essentially attempted to assault her. And my response was not, oh my gosh, we have to report this guy or this is totally unacceptable. My friend and I were writing back and forth about this other girl and saying, what did she think was going to happen if she went alone to a professor's house? I told her not to do that. Well, what did she expect, you know? I mean, that was just the orientation back then, was that it was on us as girls, again, not to be assaulted, as opposed to being on men not to assault.
Your daughter's in her late teens, right?
She's 16.
So did writing about boys and sex make you worry more about your daughter?
We have a policy that I no longer talk about my daughter in public, so I can't really say too much about her. But I will say this. Having done these two books has allowed me to learn how to have these conversations. And my daughter and I talk in ways that I never would have dreamed of talking with my own parents, and that in some ways I never would have dreamed I would have been able to talk like with my own daughter. So it has been a real boon to me as a parent to do this work, because I learned how to do it, and I think that ultimately she will benefit by that. I can see her benefiting by that.
Peggy Orenstein, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Peggy Orenstein is the author of the new book, Boys and Sex, Young Men on Hookups, Love, Porn, Consent, and Navigating the New Masculinity. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mooj Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Noom, offering a personalized weight loss program based on a cognitive behavioral approach with the goal of losing weight and keeping it off for good. Learn more at Noom, Noom.com. And from Progressive Insurance, comparing car insurance rates from multiple insurers so shoppers can evaluate options in one place. Now that's Progressive. Comparisons available at Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE.